Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode, 282 of Registry Matters. How are you this fine Saturday evening? How are you?
Doing perfect. Nothing to complain about.
Not anything this week? You're not going to complain about your foot hurts, you can't get enough sleep, this hurts, your hot water's... Oh, wait, how's your heater?
Oh, it is being taught a lesson for the fourth season in a row.
But you did get... Wasn't it just the pilot light?
Well, we thought that last year, but the guy... I got it going, and it lasted about a week, and it went out again, and so... I'm letting it know I can do without it.
Maybe you have a ghost in there that every time it gets lit, they go and blow it out for you.
Well, it's old school with a standing pilot, and those things have a mechanism in them called a thermocouple, and they fail, and that's probably all it is. But who needs
isn't that
heat?
Going to be like a $10 fix?
Probably a little more than that, but who needs heat?
Okay, didn't you send me that in your neck of the woods? It was in the 20s. You had colder weather than where I am?
I did, but I can make do with auxiliary heat. You people are too spoiled.
Oh, okay, man. All right, then. Well, okay, so make sure that you go over and you press like and subscribe over on the YouTube channel. You can even click the little tick, 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 like you see up there on the screen and get notification bells, and this feeds the algorithm. Then go over in your podcast app and make sure that you like and subscribe and leave a review there. If you do nothing more than subscribe and leave a review, I'd be super happy. But if you want to, then certainly go over to patreon.com/registrymatters and become a supporting member of the show. And then Larry gets really happy and he does a happy dance. And I might end up with some sort of video of Larry doing the happy dance at some point. And then as a patron, you would be able to see Larry do the happy dance. And everything would be great then. Every day would be great if we could see Larry do a happy dance. Can you do a happy dance, Larry?
I sure can, but you left one thing off of that. I also strive very hard to make sure I say something offensive enough to run people off.
This is very true. And the more patrons we have, probably the harder you would try. Is that true?
That's true, but I can't seem to get rid of some of them.
Some of them, no. Some of them actually agree with everything that you say, so they dig their heels in deeper. But without all of that going on, Larry, what are we going to do this evening?
The bulk of the program is going to be a discussion about a case that originated in North Carolina versus Stein. North Carolina RSOL and NARSOL, and I forgot how many parties, but it's a case that's been pending for several years. And we're going to dissect the trial court's decision. 60 pages. You've read all 60 pages, right?
Multiple times.
So you spent your whole weekend reading this.
So far, yeah. I mean, started last night, cut out all playtime, didn't do anything. I just read and I took notes, and I have a series of questions and dialogue to carry out with you here coming up.
Well, and also we have an email that was sent making the rounds to legislators here in my state. And since I work for one of them, I have access to the incoming email, which is part of my job to review and handle. And I'm going to let people know how we handle mass emails. And hopefully it would be an educational moment. If you're going to write to a lawmaker, this will be some things I'll give you pointers on what to do and what not to do when you're writing.
Well, let's head right over there. I'm going to put on my snarkiest snark voice that I can. So here we go. Dear Senator Nutjob, as your constituent, I'm aware that an interim legislative committee is discussing extreme gun control proposals this week, including semi-automatic firearm bans and magazine limits, age restrictions on firearm purchases, waiting periods, and legislation paving the way for lawsuits to bankrupt the firearms industry. Failed gun control schemes the legislature has already passed, such as universal background checks and red flag gun confiscation legislation, have not made New Mexico any safer. It is time that lawmakers focus on targeting criminals instead of restricting law-abiding citizens' Second Amendment rights with additional misguided unconstitutional proposals. Please oppose any gun control legislation in 2024. Sincerely, Kevin E. Crazy Person at 123 Main Street. All of those places at nutjob@somewhere.com.
Yes, that is an email that was sent in large quantities. And you being a tech guru, you can probably explain it better than I do, but as best I can understand, the advocates for these emails, they tell you to email your legislator, and they make it very simple. You can go follow their link, and you can email your legislator, and it supposedly directs you to your senator or your representative. And they send these things to us, and they start coming in fast and furious. The first one or two gets past me because I don't know that they have been composed by an advocacy of any kind. So the first one or two get an answer, a response, before I realize that we're being inundated. And then if the boss hasn't caught on to it when they start coming fast and furious, what we do with these is we create a spam filter that has like the words, the keywords are in this email, and we direct these to the spam folder so that they no longer throw us off the air. Because the gun advocates, the pro-gun lobby, they can generate emails faster than you can hit delete, and I'm not kidding. If you're just sitting here with incoming emails, they can have your box going faster than you can hit delete.
I believe it. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be hard as your constituent, but I'm sure many, many emails come in that way, so look for something else. But it's not hard for them to do it. But okay, so from the layperson side of this, Larry, when one first becomes involved and someone says, well, write letters to your legislator, what do you want me to say? Well, we have this form letter, so send this out. Don't change anything. Change it if you want to, but you can use this exactly as it is and send it to your legislator, you know, state, federal, senator, whatever it is. Click on this link to go find your legislator. What else are you supposed to do if you know nothing of what you're supposed to do, Larry?
Well, some basic clues would be when you click on the link that they send you, and I don't get these links on the front side. But you need to make a determination whether you want to address your representative or your senator. So in the salutation, we sanitized this email because we didn't want to out the person who sent it or the person who was the intended recipient. But when the form will come across, it'll say, "Dear Senator or Representative." So let's pretend you know nothing. So make a determination of if you want it to go to a senator or a representative. So then change the salutation to reflect that.
Yeah, and make it say, "Dear my senator or my representative," whoever that is.
Now, some of them, again, this is out of my field of expertise, but some of them, I think you click in your address and it pairs it up with the program.
Correct.
That tells you who your senator or representative is. And sometimes.
Absolutely.
That's not apparently the case because I'll get them where it says, "Dear Senator or Representative" or "Dear Legislator." If it starts with that, please make sure that when you hit send, it doesn't say "Dear Legislator" or "Dear Senator or Representative." have an intended recipient. And then with this, like I say, he would have put the keywords about extreme gun, Second Amendment, stuff like that. And then all these would have started going to the spam folder. But all you would have to do is take this email and you could tailor it and maybe put in a personal experience of some kind that why you feel that way. If I receive an email that I think is personally written, I do my best to respond to it. Because if you took the time to compose it, in my view, you deserve a response.
It's reasonable, Larry.
If you took no time or effort at all and you just clicked something, you're less deserving of a response. That's just proving to us that you can generate background noise, that the organization can generate background noise. But if you actually say something that looks like you composed it, you're almost certain to get a response from us. And I can't speak for the 111 other legislators, but I know many of them feel the same way from my interaction through the years. They feel the same way. If you write something yourself, it's going to get a response. So do the best you can to personalize it, make sure it's targeting the right person, and put something in there that you composed and try to do away with just the form. Because when I get a few of these, I immediately let him know that that we're receiving mass emails, and then he takes care of it on the backside, and they all of a sudden quit coming to my attention because they're going to spam and we don't look at them anymore.
And what about the length? Just not, I don't want to talk about the content here, but the length of it. Is this the appropriate length? Should it be, if you put in a personal experience, it's going to be at least a little, if not a lot longer.
This is just fine on length. You could take some of this out and you can put in a personal experience. The bankrupting thing, nobody's going to bankrupt the firearm industry with lawsuits. That's hyperbole. Take that out. That would be my best advice to folks, is to don't just follow those links and send these things. Do a little bit of work yourself if you want to be taken seriously. Oh, one other thing. If we respond to you, I don't know how these work on the backside, but hardly anybody ever responds back to us thanking us. If I take the time to compose a personal response, and by all, as far as they can tell, it's coming from the senator. You know, it doesn't say staff, it comes from the senator. If the senator takes the time to respond to you, at least give a thank you, senator, for your time. Do that.
I'm with you. I mean, depending on whose platform they're using to get all that information put together. Yeah, I don't know. I certainly watch all the email logs for a bunch of different places, and I know how it all works. I just, how they're doing it, I don't know. God, I had another question for you. Oh, have you experienced anybody using any of the AI text generators to scramble this text to make it into a different sentence that would get past your filters? Have you experienced it yet?
How would we know that?
Yeah. I realize, I mean, that's the appropriate question. I just know that I've been doing this a lot in the last little few weeks. I've been rewording product descriptions for a client, and it comes out nothing like what went in, and I tell it to not change anything other than like reword a sentence, but the details as I read through it still look identical, but now the whole sentence and everything is all different. So I don't know how anybody's going to catch on. And that seems like that would be, here's the email we want to go out and run it through ChatGPT or Bard or whatever service you want to use, and you will get back an entirely different thing that looks the same, has the same feel. You can even have it change the tone of it. I did a funny experiment with my kid Larry. I asked it to write a report about George Washington in like King Arthur in Old English. It was like, hear ye. I'm like, it threw the whole thing out using a different like dialect, so to speak. It's fascinating what it can do. And you just throw in those little coloring terms of use extra slang, make it snarky, make it super professional, and it adheres to those rules. It's amazing.
Well, for example, if he put it extreme gun control, how would they be able to get that out if they had it reordered by automation? What would make that? Because that's one of the buzzwords they want in there. See, that's part of their talking points, extreme gun control. Everything to them is extreme. So how would they be able to get that out of there? Because if you use that as a keyword, we would continue to pick up on that no matter how much they change the rest of the email.
All right. Well, then just since we're in here doing this, and I think we have a couple minutes that we can burn. All right. I just ran it through ChatGPT, and I'm going to read to you what I just read. As a resident in your constituency, that's terribly worded, but it is different. I want to bring to your attention that an interim legislative committee is currently deliberating on strict gun control measures this week. These measures include bans on semi-automatic firearms and magazine limits, age restrictions on firearm purchases, waiting periods, and legislation that could lead to lawsuits against the firearms industry. See, it didn't say bankrupt them, it just said lawsuits against. That would be true.
Sure.
The gun control policies previously enacted by the legislature, such as universal background checks and red flag gun control confiscations laws, have not effectively improved safety in New Mexico. It is crucial for legislators to shift their focus towards targeting criminal activity than imposing further misguided and potentially unconstitutional restrictions on Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. I urge you to oppose any gun control legislation in 24.
Well, that is a significant change, but we'd still get you on the Second Amendment. You'd have to make sure that you get that out of there, because I'm sure that was one of the words that he was flagging.
Yeah, sure. Certainly. But you probably get messages like that are legit about that. And if you target Second Amendment, you would end up with canning messages from people that are legitimately talking about it.
Well, that's, I guess, the price they pay for using mass emails. But another thing that he taught me was that he will actually come down on the advocacy organization that's causing this, particularly if he's already if he's in alignment with their position and they're bombarding us. And it really does knock us off the air, because this is actually how they do their work. When you watch them on the floor, they have their laptops. They're watching for like an updated piece of amendment, if there's language problems with a bill that they're debating. And they're watching for important emails. And if we're being spammed by hundreds of emails, you can't see the one from the bill drafter or whatever's important that's coming. So what he does is, if he's already in alignment with the organization and they're too stupid and incompetent to remove him from the people that they're targeting, he will call up their lobbyists and say, if you don't knock it off, I'm going to vote the other way. I need you to stop the blast of emails that are coming. So I'm talking now to you advocates.
Interesting.
If you already have that lawmaker won over to your point of view, don't spam their boxes.
Right. But yeah, it totally becomes a denial of service attack that you can't see the emails that are important because they're being flooded by all the other things. I'm totally with it. Well, okay, so there's your legislative advocacy work lesson of the day of how to correspond emaily. Is that a word? Emaily?
We'll find out when the transcript is prepared.
How to correspond with your representative through email. Well, then we shall move over to this case that you have your panties all up in a wad, Larry, about this North Carolina versus Stein. And it's a long running case that you want to focus on. And it's Narsal versus Stein. And that's the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws versus Joshua Stein. I know who Narsal is, but who in the F-bomb expletive here, who is Joshua Stein?
That would be the Attorney General of the state of North Carolina.
That sounds like a low-hanging fruit. Like, that's a nobody.
Really?
Okay, so this case was intended to be the big one. Like, oh my God, Louise, I'm coming to visit you. It's the big one to bring down the North Carolina registry. That's and the attorney was Mr. Dubling. Did it succeed?
Unfortunately, it did not. It actually failed miserably.
Miserably. All right, let me read directly from the judge's decision. And this is Judge Biggs said, plaintiffs contend that four amendments to the North Carolina PFR and Public Protection Registry, the registry, which were enacted as early as 2006 and have been applied retroactively to PFRs, violate the ex post facto clause of the United States Constitution. So what did the plaintiffs seek in this lawsuit?
They sought a declaratory decision and injunctive relief, meaning that they wanted the court to declare the PFR registry unconstitutional, and they wanted an injunction prohibiting any future enforcement.
According to the plaintiffs, the challenged amendments to the registry represent a punitive regime of affirmative restraint that creates homelessness, wholesale exclusion from the community, and from various employment opportunities otherwise available to registrants. Now, tell me, Larry, can you not concede that the registry does all of those things?
Oh, I can indeed. Unfortunately, the plaintiffs did not prove their assertions in the trial. Defendants countered, that would be the state, that the registry and the challenged amendments to the registry codified in Chapter 14, Article 274A of the North Carolina General Statutes were not intended to impose criminal punishment, but rather as a civil regulatory scheme to assist law enforcement in protecting the community. Also, they argued that the plaintiffs have failed to carry their burden of showing that the clearest of proof, now remember that clearest of proof, that despite the legislative intent, the challenged statutory scheme is so punitive in effect as to negate the legislative intent to deem it civil. And the court agreed. They had not done that.
According to the court, in 1995, North Carolina's General Assembly enacted the Amy Jackson Law, a PFR registration program. The General Assembly recognized that PFRs often pose a high risk of engaging in sexual activities even after being released from incarceration, and that protection of the public from PFRs is of paramount governmental interest. It drives you over the edge when we talk about recidivism, though, Larry. Yet in North Carolina, the General Assembly stated that offenders pose a high risk of engaging in sex offenses even after prison. Can you not see that recidivism is important?
it can be important in the right circumstances. Unfortunately, when making a constitutional challenge, recidivism is not a valid claim. Regardless of the rate of recidivism, the fact is that a non-punitive regulatory scheme can be imposed on people retroactively, as long as the scheme is non-punitive. It can be imposed. And it can be imposed just simply because the people want to do it. Remember, we're a government of the people.
The court went on to include this next passage as well. Part of the General Assembly's stated purpose for creating the registry was to assist law enforcement agencies' effort to protect communities by requiring persons who are convicted of PFR-type offenses or of certain other offenses committed against minors to register with law enforcement agencies to require the exchange of relevant information about those offenders among law enforcement agencies and to authorize the access to necessary and relevant information about those offenders to others as provided in this article. Now, I'm sure you're going to spin this some kind of kooky way. So what you got?
Well, there's no spin needed. It's not anything that comes close to the proof that's needed to show that the intent of the lawmakers was that the registry be punitive. In fact, testimony of one of the witnesses called for our side conceded that he could find no such proof of the sinister motivations.
The North Carolina General Assembly amended the law multiple times, but the most significant changes occurred in 2006. According to the court, effective December 1, 2006, the General Assembly amended the registry to require registration for a period of at least 10 years following the date of initial county registration. For registrants whose registration period would terminate on or after December 1, 2006, those who had not committed a subsequent offense requiring registration could petition the Superior Court for termination of the registration requirement 10 years after the date of the initial county registration. I'm guessing that was a change in the removal process?
I'm guessing that as well. I think it's correct. But prior to 2006, my recollection is that the person just simply timed out, but a listener can correct us if we're wrong, but I think that's the way it worked.
And to clarify, that means do nothing and you just fall off the list?
Yes, they would have received a letter from the state saying your term of registration has expired.
I see. Okay. And then also that same year, the General Assembly required in-person reporting by registrants for change of address and semi-annual in-person verification of registry information. The General Assembly prohibited registered PFRs from working or volunteering in the instruction, supervision, or care of a minor and from knowingly residing within 1,000 feet of property on which any public or non-public school or child daycare center is located. This list sure does sound like one of these Kennedy Mendoza things of disabilities and restraints. It sounds like that to me.
It sounds that way to me as well.
So then this should be a slam dunk.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then in 2008, the General Assembly amended the registry to establish a 30-year registration requirement for people convicted of certain offenses, with an opportunity for those people to petition to shorten their registration period after 10 years. That same year, they also shortened the time for registrants to return verification forms, making reportable changes of residency and report an intent to move out of state from 10 days to 3 business days. What else did they do?
Well, the General Assembly enacted premises restrictions. The restrictions at issue in this case include a ban on registrants from the premises of any place intended primarily for the use, care, or supervision of minors, including, but not limited to, schools, children's museums, child care centers, nurseries, and playgrounds, and from being within 300 feet of such locations, including but not limited to those located in malls, shopping centers, and other property open to the general public.
After reading that list of prohibitions, can you finally admit that the North Carolina Registry imposes significant disabilities and restraints?
I can admit that, but the proof in this case was inadequate for the court.
It should also be noted that in 2009, the General Assembly restricted registrants from obtaining or maintaining a commercial driver's license for the operation of commercial passenger vehicles or school buses. Does this not prohibit a person from making a living, Larry?
It interferes with some occupational opportunities, but these restrictions do not foreclose all employment. not even a small fraction of employment opportunities, but it does definitely, it is a disability and restraint, no doubt.
One of the witnesses for our side was Dwayne Daughtry. Daughtry is a member and a board member of both North Carolina RSOL and NARSOL. He testified that he reviewed the above-referenced bills as well as reports, transcripts, and audio recordings of legislative committee and subcommittee meetings at the time of their passage. During that review, Mr. Daughtry found no discussion or written reference to the recidivism rates of PFRs or to the efficacy of sex offender laws in reducing recidivism. He found no evidence of express statements of intent by the legislature for any of the statutory amendments was presented at trial. This was apparently important, though?
It was. The court stated, based on Mr. Daughtry's testimony, the court finds no evidence in the legislative record that the North Carolina legislature intended the relevant statutes to be punitive. Now remember, we bear the burden. Now can you at least admit that that's funny when one of your own witnesses makes the state's case stronger?
That sounds like an attorney's worst nightmare to me, honestly. And I don't think that it's very funny at all. Now, you have this really weird notion of what's funny, though. And so we will move on from there because of that. The court even recognized that enforcement of the registry laws is problematic. Maybe you can agree with my next line of thought. On paragraph 33, it states, in practice, how the registry laws are administered and enforced is highly discretionary among and within the respective law enforcement agencies responsible for its enforcement in the various prosecutorial districts. Officers testify that they undertake a full investigation of possible violations and consider, among other things, the intent of the registrant and surrounding circumstances. Further, there are no standards related to how compliance checks under the statutes must be conducted, the frequency and manner in which law enforcement conducts in-person compliance checks at the homes of registered individuals varies among sheriffs and counties. I've heard you pontificate for years. Listen to me, Larry. I've heard you do this for years. That a law can be declared unconstitutional if it is so poorly written that it can be arbitrarily enforced.
You are correct. I have said that many times in the past. There's only one problem. The plaintiffs did not assert that the law was void for vagueness. You read their entire litany of complaints, and I do not recall that you read a void for vagueness challenge among them. The court cannot invent counts that are not asserted by the parties.
I gotta say, you're hopeless. Don't we want them to be super legislators, Larry?
Well, remember, they're neutral parties, so when the complaint is rendered by the party initiating the action, wouldn't it be great if the court came in and said, well, you know, Mr. Dooming, I can think of some other things that you didn't bring up. You know, I kind of like this registry much myself, and I would like to do a little ex parte communication with you. I've got some suggestions for you. I mean, the judge can't do that.
You're hopeless.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Plaintiff John Doe testified that he has been subject to multiple instances of harassment in the community. During these instances of harassment, John testified that he was referred to as a... I'm not saying these things, Larry. I'm not saying them. So he says bad words about the person, and you can fill in the blank of whatever your worst imagination could come up with. So I'll leave it at that. And as someone who hurts women and messes with children, those are really like the nice versions of what they call them. Can you not admit that that's a direct result of the registry?
I can admit that is possibly and probably a direct result. But unfortunately, on cross-examination, plaintiff John Doe testified that all the information contained on his registry profile could also be obtained from publicly available criminal conviction records. Additionally, Mr. Doe testified that there's at least one incident of harassment where the harasser personally knew him and the circumstances of his guilty plea, and the harassment was not a result of the registry. He testified to that. The reality is that John could not confirm whether these harassers found out about the circumstances of his underlying crime from the registry or from gossip. And if you assert the registry is the cause, be prepared with to offer proof.
The registry prevents people from holding jobs too, Larry. The court noted, though, John Doe was employed at the time of the trial. He testified that his presence on the registry created a significant barrier to his finding employment. From 2010 until 2016, John operated a towing business but stopped to care for his ailing father. John also has worked as a bodyguard for private clients since being released from prison. John testified about his status and, John testified about various other jobs he has held or for which he applied that he believes were adversely impacted by his registry status. John acknowledged that he was at times, that he has lost at times, lost jobs when a business collapsed or once he was involved in an altercation with a customer.
Now, that's funny.
But you know, if you get into a fight with a customer, you're probably going to keep your job.
But again, John Doe did not provide the court with any written documentation or any compelling documentation showing that his registry status was the reason for being denied a position or losing one. Remember, folks, we need proof. We have to show proof. Remember, he said he believed he lost jobs. That's not good enough.
So let's talk about residency restrictions then. In paragraph 49, the court stated, with regard to the residency restrictions, John Doe testified that, following his release from prison, he attempted to find housing in at least 20 places, but was unsuccessful because of his registry status. John stated that most of these locations had either playgrounds or childcare centers on their grounds. John testified that even after expanding his search to trailer parks and Section 8 housing, he and his wife were only able to find a place to live when his wife applied under her name alone. Now, give me your spin on that, Mr. Doom and Gloom.
Well, on cross-examination, John acknowledged that his ability to find housing was at least in part affected by his low income and lack of strong credit history. John testified at least once his credit history was provided as the reason for his application for a mortgage being denied. The court stated, quote, the evidence therefore shows that while his registry status may have been a factor in his denial of housing, a number of other factors, to include poor credit score, his inability to provide proof of income due to his being self-employed or being paid in cash, were likewise factors in being denied housing. You need to pick good clients, folks, and you need to provide proof. Now, I'm that nasty guy that says, when you start telling me your story, I start saying, do you have proof? Do you have proof? What is your evidence? And you get mad at me and you go down to the lawyer that babies you and tells you what you want to hear. But I tell you, this is what we're up against. This is what we're going to need. And for some reason, they walk out of our office.
May we move on then from this little section?
Sure.
All right. Well, I mean, not from this case. We'll move on from this little subsection. The court then stated, with regard to the challenged premises restrictions, John Doe testified regarding the impact of the registry on his ability to be present at certain places and engage with the community. John Doe testified that it was his understanding that he was not permitted to visit the Alamance. I have no idea. Alamance? I don't know the name of that county.
I don't begin to know how to pronounce that.
Alamance, Alamance County Library, because it contains a children's section. He also stated that the former sergeant at the sheriff's office, Jackie Fortner, instructed him that he cannot visit parks if any minor is in the park, and that he could not go to a McDonald's because it has a play place. John also described an instance where he was grocery shopping with his father at a Food Lion, when an off-duty sheriff told him that he had to leave because children were congregating there. Seriously? John also discussed the government buildings in Alamance County that he is not permitted to visit, including the Veterans Service Office and the Register of Deeds, because these buildings have a playground on the property. Now, this definitely starts to cross the line in my mind about what we would call disabilities and restraints.
Well, it would. And I deliberately put that county in your section because I knew I couldn't pronounce it.
You're evil. I have no idea how to pronounce it. I'm going to look it up because that's bothering me. But please continue.
So it does look like disabilities or restraints, definitely. But unfortunately, plaintiff selection is so important. Regarding political activities and events, John Doe testified that he wanted to attend certain events at locations where he is not permitted to be present, including community centers and college campuses. Specifically, he testified about a Donald Trump rally and a Bernie Sanders event that he was unable to attend due to the location of the events. On cross-examination, John Doe acknowledged that he was present during a protest at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill's campus, and was arrested for possession of a knife. And not being on the a registered sex offender on college campus, that was not the reason. Now, can you admit that that's funny?
Not funny. None of this is funny. How do you think that this is funny?
Well, you've got to screen your plaintiffs, folks. If you're going to go to trial, you're going to have to screen the people that you are going to put on that stand.
I have looked up the pronunciation, and this is Allemans County. Oh, that's county. So it's Allemans. Allemans. And I was like, what is county? Oh, that's how you pronounce county, Larry. K-O-W-N-T-E-E. County. Okay, so it's Allemans. Anyway, it's not funny, Larry. None of this is funny because these are people that are seriously impacted by this stuff, and you keep shooting all this stuff down like it's nothing. You're mean. But you have often pontificated that we need to call experts at trial and not move for summary judgment. This case went to trial. Were there experts called?
They were, but before we get to the experts, I'd like to point out that Mr. Dubling did file a motion for summary judgment. And fortunately, the court denied his motion and indicated there were material facts in dispute. This means, despite all my pontifications, they continue to seek resolution by summary judgment, even when there are disputed facts. Folks, summary judgment is something where there's only a matter of law to be determined. Factually, all the parties agree on everything. If there are any facts in dispute, you need a trial. You need for an evidentiary record to be developed, and you need for a court to make a determination on the credibility of the witnesses and the evidence that is tagged and admitted into evidence. You can't accomplish this because the state is never going to make concessions. They're not going to stipulate to the things you want them to stipulate to so that you don't have to do a trial. But he tried to do summary judgment, but the court didn't let him. So the question might be, how prepared was he for trial when he didn't get summary judgment? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But based on what I'm seeing here, it looks like he could have possibly been better prepared.
The judges stated plaintiffs offered the testimony of several witnesses, many of whom conducted studies regarding the impact of registry laws generally on housing, employment, education, and registrants' ability to visit certain locations. Plaintiffs called Mr. William Sexton Cooper to testify as an expert witness. He serves as a consultant in demographics and mapping to various civil rights organizations, nonprofits, and local governments across the United States, primarily focusing on voting issues. As a consultant, Mr. Cooper draws voting plans which requires using demographic data in the United States Census Bureau, particularly the geographic files produced annually and every 10 years, the underlying population data from the decennial census, the information from the American Community Survey, and then what did Mr. Cooper's testimony reveal?
Well, in this case, Mr. Cooper determined the exclusion zones by examining the population and housing units within the corporate limits of the three largest cities in North Carolina, those being Charlotte, Raleigh, and Greensboro. Using the 2010 census data, Mr. Cooper determined that 49% of the population in Charlotte, what did you do to my screen?
I didn't do anything to it.
That 49% of the population in Charlotte, you got to finish that. I don't see
okay,
it.
That's fine. So 48.3% of the population in Raleigh and 42.8% of the population in Greensboro are within the exclusion zone. With regard to housing units, Mr. Cooper found that 49.4% of the housing units in Charlotte and 47.5% of the housing units in Raleigh and 41.9% of the housing units in Greensboro are within the exclusion zones. This testimony hardly rises to the level of banishment, Remember the case in Lewisville, Texas, where about 90% of the housing units were off limits?
Yeah, so now I can see where we were. So do you remember that case from Lewisville, Texas, where the evidence showed that 90% of the residential housing stock was off limits? And that
Was this the home rule one?
Not that particular issue, but this was a case that Richard Gladden brought. And he used a woman named Duarte as a family member of a registrant, and he said that since 90% of Lewisville was off sentence, off limits, that constituted banishment. And the trial judge and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said, nope, doesn't.
Not even 90%? Good grief, dude. Like, here's this tiny little carve-out that's a 10 by 10 plot of land that you can live in.
So based on the Fifth Circuit, which is different than this, this in the Fourth Circuit, but if 90% being off limits, and these cities, like you read the numbers, they range from, 42.8 to 49%. But that means over half of the housing stock is still available. So it hardly constitutes banishment. So therefore, your claim doesn't prevail. It's not banishment.
Do you mind if we go back to the employment restrictions?
Oh, yeah. I see you're obsessed about employment restrictions.
I want you to admit that the registry prevents people from having employment.
Well, I've admitted that already.
Mr. Andrew Casey Dahl testified regarding the difficulties felons and PFR registrants experience in obtaining employment. In 2010, Mr. Dahl began serving on the employment team of Durham Congregations, Associations, and Neighborhoods, a grassroots organization committee that is part of the International Association of Federations. What is this, Star Trek? That sounds like a Star Trek name to me. The role of the employment team is to improve outcomes for people with high barriers to employment. Mr. Dahl discussed the various barriers of employment to felons, including lack of education, hard skills, and soft skills. Further, he testified that the types of employment generally available to the felons he works with are either janitorial, food service, or construction positions. Mr. Dahl also discussed how the availability of these jobs differs for registrants. For janitorial positions, Mr. Dahl testified that the registry's premise restrictions form difficulties because of the variety of locations, businesses, and that janitorial positions require registrants to service. That would be like, hey, we need a janitorial service to go clean a daycare. How many kids are going to be at the daycare when you're doing the cleaning services at 2 o'clock in the morning, Larry?
Probably not that many.
Then for food service, the difficulty arises from the employment of what? Minors. Because minors generally work at fast food joints. And then the lack of ability for registrants to supervise or instruct a minor. For construction, the problem involves the ability for a registrant to verify with the sheriff's department whether they are permitted to attend the job site before the job begins. Mr. Dahl further testified that registrants tend to work jobs that are lower paid, not paid by a paycheck, and that do have benefits, and they do not provide workers' compensation for them. So what do you say about all that about Mr. Dahl?
He was a great witness. I agree with everything he said, and he was a good witness for our side.
And we have to go back to recidivism, because I can't let that one go.
You just keep...
All right. All right. So we're going to get you worked up again for this reason. Plaintiffs offered the testimony and reports of two expert witnesses regarding recidivism rates of PFRs and the efficacy of PFR laws. The court qualified Dr. Keith Hirsch as an expert in the areas of recidivism rates of sexual offenders, the psychology of PFRs, offending, and recidivism, and the efficacy of treatment. Dr. Hirsch testified that sexual offense recidivism rates for adult sex offenders in the United States is about 3-6% within the 3-year period following their release into the community. The rate of those who will commit a new sex offense between 3 years and 5 decreases among those who remained offense-free during the first 3 years. After the 5 years following the release into the community, the rate of recidivism continues to decrease and approaches zero over time. That testimony seems like it should hold some weight to me.
Well, I agree. It does hold some weight, but also you omitted part of the testimony, I'm sure, deliberately. When you were how many times did you say you read this case?
I read, but I could only get so much of it in here.
So, well, Dr. Hirsch also testified that At approximately year 10, the risk of the PFR committing a sexual offense is nearly indistinguishable from that from the non-offender. He further testified that the rate of sexual offenders committing a new crime is approximately 20% lower than the general recidivism rate of non-PFR type offenders. But that still does not matter. As I stated numerous times, this argument cannot be won for a number of reasons. First, the Supreme Court did not hold that the registry was constitutional due to the high recidivism rate. That was merely dicta, not a significant factor. Second, the rate of recidivism is never zero, which then begs the question of how much recidivism is okay.
So, are you suggesting that we ignore recidivism altogether?
No, we should not ignore it altogether. We should use it in legislative arguments in the right venue. It's not a winning hand, especially when your own expert witness testifies the way Dr. Hirsch did. Dr. Hirsch testified that a 2010 study of National Crime Victim Survey found that approximately 50% of all PFR type offenses are not even reported. Dr. Hirsch further testified that the recidivism rates were underestimated, but he was unable to identify the exact amount. Dr. Hirsch testified that he agreed with the widely accepted notion that the official recorded number of recidivism rates for PFR offenders was diluted the measure of reoffense.
I do see that also then in paragraph 150. So considering the 50% of unreported sex offenses, Dr. Hirsch testified that he estimates that reoffense rates within the three-year time frame following release would raise from 3% to 6% to closer to something like 6 to 12%.
Yes, and you did notice the source of that study, right?
I see that it was the National Crime Victims.
Yes, and that's the people that we somehow just believe they're people up in Connecticut and other states that just believe we're going to work hand in hand with these people, and they are the biggest source of our problems.
We should move over to my personal favorite, Larry. I think it's probably one of yours. Is Kennedy Mendoza Martinez test? May we go over that way?
Sure.
All right. So in Smith versus Doe, the Supreme Court found that the following Mendoza Martinez factors were most relevant to its analysis: whether the regulatory scheme, and this is one, has been regarded in our history and traditions as punishment; two, imposes an affirmative disability or restraint; number three, promotes the traditional aims of punishment; number four, has a rational connection to a non-punitive purpose; number five, is excessive with respect to its purpose. The court noted that Mendoza-Martinez factors are neither exhaustive nor dispositive, but rather useful guideposts. I assume that the judge found no punitive intent.
Correct. In paragraph 27, the court thus concludes that the registry was intended as a non-punitive civil regulatory scheme.
Resemblance to traditional forms of punishment? What did the court find on that one?
The court found the record does not contain evidence demonstrating that the publication of information on the PFR website resembles traditional forms of punishment. Now remember, we claim that we're originalist. We don't want to have that evolving stuff over time. And this doesn't resemble any punishment of colonial times. Next quote, our system does not treat dissemination of truthful information in furtherance of a legitimate objective as punishment. This is just simply restating what's already been factually determined.
Another one they listed was, what about the traditional form of punishment via banishment?
Well, again, we love our original interpretation. There are a lot of people that are in this audience that believe that they should all be originalists. And the Supreme Court has explained that banishment of offenders historically meant that they could not return to their original community. And that was banishment of an offender. They were expelled from the community. North Carolina law does not expel anyone from a community. And the court also stated that the record reveals a low number of identifiable homeless individuals on the PFR registry. Of 25,063 on the North Carolina registry, only 411 are classified as homeless. Now, maybe we ought to reconsider that perhaps a broader look at how to interpret law. But if you're into that original interpretation, and the board management should be interpreted as it was understood in colonial times. It was understood in colonial times to mean expelled. They have not been expelled. They have had some exclusion zones, but they have not been expelled. So this is not banishment as defined in colonial times.
And then what about the registry being the same as probation? What are you going to do to spin that one, Mr. Fancy Pants?
Well, it's not even close. You can just read directly in paragraph 244. The conditions of probation were set forth in North Carolina General Statute number 15A, 134, subsection A1, and may include the following: house arrest, community service, submission to a period or periods of confinement in a local confinement facility, substance abuse assessment, treatment and monitoring, abstention from alcohol consumption, and even submission to alcohol monitoring. None of these conditions apply as conditions of the registry. Perhaps maybe on Halloween, you might be told to stay home, and that usually applies to people who are under supervision. But regular conditions of probation, in addition, must include the following: remaining in the jurisdiction unless the court grants written permission, or the probation officer does, reporting to a probation officer as directed by the court or a probation officer, satisfying child support obligations, remaining gainfully employed, pursuing a course of study at school that may be a part of conditions of probation that you rehabilitate yourself, attending abuser or counseling, and a program if for domestic violence. There's a number of things that you're required to do on probation that the registry can't require you to do. So people who say that it's the same, it's not the same. I'm hopeless. What do you mean I'm hopeless?
I'm just saying you're hopeless because there are the registry does do a lot. It doesn't impose the getting a job per se, but it's very debilitating.
But you can't say it's the same as probation. There's some very limited similarities. You have a reporting schedule. In many jurisdictions, like, for example, if you have a 4 times a year obligation, they'll give you a schedule and they'll tell you that you come in within 10 days of your birthday or whatever. But there are similarities. But as recognized in Smith, unlike a violation of a condition of probation or post-release supervision or parole that could result in revocation and imprisonment without any new criminal charges or a trial, in contrast, any violation of the registry would require a full prosecution from arrest, an indictment, to trial and appeal before the state could impose any punishment. So in that regard, it's dramatically different. They can yank your probation for the slightest technical violation. They can't yank your registry for that because they have to bring a criminal charge against you.
I'm going to make a little side note here, Larry, that anybody that is on the website in Florida, listen to that little section over and over again when you're not living in Florida, but you're on their website. What's the threat of prosecution if you're just quote-unquote on their website?
Well, I don't know of any threat of prosecution from just being on the website.
That's my point. I'm just using that sort of like, because there's no threat of prosecution. They can't do these things to you. None of those things apply to you. You're just on a website.
Well, it's not just a website. That's irritating, and it has its drawbacks, but it's not the same as being actively registered. And I don't know why I have to have this argument over and over again, because I get hate mail every single time saying how stupid I am that I can't understand that being on the website is the same as being registered. And I don't know why I have to keep explaining. You have no conditions being on a website. None. You're not obligated to do anything.
To move along, in Smith versus Doe, the Supreme Court considered whether the challenged Alaska statutes imposed physical restraints or resembled the punishment of imprisonment, which is the paradigmatic affirmative disability or restraint. The judge stated, "The record supports that those subject to the challenged amendments are free to change jobs, residence, and alter their physical appearance with no supervision. Nor do the challenged amendments require plaintiffs or other registrants to seek permission to change jobs, residences, or alter their physical appearances. Do you agree?
I do. The evidence before the court showed this to be the case. The court, it says, the court finds that the residency, employment, and premises restrictions contained in the challenged amendments, as well as the in-person registration requirements, impose at most a minor indirect disabilities or restraints. I disagree that they're minor indirect. But I do agree that you don't have to get permission to do these things. You can do these things. You can move to any place you want to. Now, if they have exclusion zones, you may find yourself in one, and you better get out of it pretty fast if you are. But you can. You don't need permission to move to any place.
Okay, so we've been going at this for probably 45 minutes because we had the other little segment. Can we move on? And what did the court say about recidivism?
Well, in paragraph 284, the court noted that plaintiffs put forward experts who contended that the registry laws do not decrease recidivism and may, in fact, increase recidivism. However, the court gives little weight to both Dr. Hershey's and Dr. Prescott's testimony in this regard, given the evidence that it's widely understood that the officially recorded recidivism rates of PFR offenders are quite a diluted measure of reoffending, and that 50% of offenses remain unreported. That's thanks to our own experts.
I am really dumbfounded by your continued obstinance on this issue. Why can't you admit that the underlying reason for the registry is not valid?
Well, I can, and I have admitted that. Unfortunately, I cannot admit that this is a basis for a solid constitutional challenge. In paragraph 291, the court stated, even if this court accepted plaintiff's contention that the sex offender recidivism is lower than commonly believed, plaintiffs have not offered credible evidence that the risk of recidivism does not exist at all. Even if a small percentage of recidivism is prevented by the challenge restrictions, the court finds that North Carolina's interest in public safety is furthered. Remember my analogy about loading a gun with 100 rounds and only one of them being a live round? I've asked how many of you would stand in front of that gun knowing that only one bullet could harm you. And I don't get any volunteers. It's not a valid argument. This is the reason the NRA never uses a similar argument. They know that an undetermined number of people could be saved with some modest restrictions on gun ownership. They know that. That's why they will not go down that path.
Can you at least admit that the North Carolina General Assembly could have made a better choice to prevent sexual offenses other than the registry?
I can admit that, but unfortunately, it's not the role of our courts to determine public policy. Paragraph 295 addresses that, and it says, quote, this court is not tasked with determining whether the North Carolina legislature has made the best choice possible to address the problem it seeks to remedy. Rather, the question before the court is whether the regulatory means chosen are reasonable in light of the non-punitive objective. And they cited Smith versus Doe, which was at 538 U.S. Reports at page 105.
Do you think, sir, that this will be appealed?
I understand the notice of appeal has already been filed.
And will that one work?
This is such a well-written opinion. It took 2 years from the trial, a little over 2 years, to render this opinion. And there's so many deferences that go to the trial judge on weighting the credibility of these witnesses, determining who to believe, how much weight to give each person's testimony. It's hard for me to believe that there's a good chance of this being overturned on appeal. Now, I certainly hope that it is, because we are fully invested in this case, both the national and the state chapter, but it's hard for me to see that this is going to be an easy lift to overturn.
Now, I just kind of have to poke fun of you, because you are the legal strategist for NARSAL, are you not?
I'm one of the team, yes.
And didn't you see all these glaring holes to be filled before this went before the court?
I did not, because this particular attorney does not consult with non-attorneys. So therefore, I didn't have anything to do with the pleadings. I didn't have anything to do with review of the pleadings. Contrast that with the Georgia case. I was provided every pleading, and I was offered feedback, and some of my feedback was actually incorporated into the pleadings in the Halloween challenge in Georgia. But this attorney is far smarter than I am.
I see. Well, clearly, as based on the outcome. Very well.
I'm glad you can understand that.
I think we should send you to some sort of like hack school where you can just pay a few $1,000 and we can get you some letters, and then you'd be, quote unquote, an attorney.
But I'm 181 years old now. I don't have the energy to do all this.
I said we would pay some money. I didn't say we would actually have you do anything.
Oh, so someone else would write it. I would just look at it.
You would just be handed a piece of paper that says graduate of the Law College of Quackery.
All righty.
I have nothing else for this evening. We are at almost 59 minutes. I don't think there's anything more that we need to cover this evening.
All right. What are we doing next week?
We are not going to be here because one of us is going to be very, 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 very far away from a microphone.
All right. So that means we'll see our audience in 2 weeks.
That is, yes, we will see them in 2 weeks. Make sure you go over to registrymatters.co where all the show notes are available and you can find links to everything, including patreon.com/registrymatters. And I don't have anything else. I think you're fantastic. Everything is great and wonderful. And the content you help provide and all that is amazing. Listeners, they are also amazing and they make all of this possible. And I appreciate each and every one of you very much. And I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.